We are joined live in the studios, actually for the first time, I was going to say once again, by Jov Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It was really nice to sleep in today.
It was.
After 22 years.
We're fresh. We'll see if it makes a difference in our commentary.
We'll let the listeners be the judge of that.
Yeah, so. I might not be quite as cranky as I usually am.
And I might be more cranky.
All right, so it's all going to balance out in the end.
Yeah.
Let's hope.
I'm looking forward to this.
Okay. All right, we also aren't at the same medication levels that we normally would be in the morning. All right, so plenty to cover this week as usual, and... Let's starting out with local and more developments in our local city council elections coming up this year.
Yeah. Bruce Harrell announced this week that he won't run for re-election. That makes him the third city council member to announce this after first Rob Johnson and then Sally Bagshaw. He will have served about 12 years on the council by the end of his current term. He announced this one day after Tammy Morales said that she is running for his District 2 seat next year in the next election. Morales almost beat him back in 2015 with a gap of only about 400 votes between the two of them. Harrell has already served as council president, but he's never been, I think, a really good fit for the job as a city council member. He's very restless at city council meetings. I don't think he does a great job listening. And he doesn't seem to be responsive to the residents of his district, although he is very responsive to business interests in the city.
Yeah, it's interesting. This being the third open seat that's opened up, and you know, Morales, when she announced her race, also announced the endorsement of Pramila Jayapal, which I think will give her a boost with fundraising, certainly if Jayapal is sharing her lists and such, which it certainly sounds like she will be. One of the interesting things is that all three of the council members that have decided not to run for re-election were three of the original four people who opposed the employee hours tax last year. This really goes against the conventional wisdom that's been flogged by the Seattle Times and various other local
the
media outlets.
The fourth being Lorena Gonzalez, right?
No, the fourth is Deborah Juarez.
Deborah Juarez, yeah.
Yes.
Although Lorena Gonzalez was in a lot of the early discussions about it.
Yes, she was. But these four all up for re-election, and Juarez has not yet said whether she's running for re-election or not, although the assumption is that she is. The interesting thing about this is that because these three very business-friendly council members are choosing not to run for re-election, that it really opens the door for a more progressive rather than a less progressive city council going forward. And this comes after the concern with the employee hours tax battle was that it really showed the way for local businesses that they could, as with the election of Mayor Durkin in 2017, that they could pour a lot of money into pro-business PACs and pretty much get the candidate of their choice elected. With with the original opponents proponents of the head tax, that being Sawant and O'Brien and Herbolt in particular, all running for re-election. Herbolt and O'Brien also have not formally announced yet, but the assumption is that they're running, and they have already drawn opponents. A lot of the energy, certainly for the business community, is going to go into trying to unseat Sawant. But it really underscores that there's going to be a lot of other progressive people running in these open seat races. And unlike Bagshaw, who is turned 68 next month and was widely expected to be considering retiring this year, and unlike Johnson, who only served one term and is widely seen as not having enjoyed being on city council and can, you know, turn around and pivot to a nice, comfortable lobbying job, Harrell's decision not to run for re-election is almost certainly tied to his concern that he wouldn't win the race. And that is not just because he's running against Morales, and Morales nearly beat him with an underfunded race that really kind of came out of nowhere with late momentum in 2015, but also the idea that he has almost certainly done private polling that shows that he's vulnerable in that race. And that underscores that, you know, probably the employee hours tax, especially in retrospect, is more popular with Seattle voters, or at least the idea of trying to meaningfully tackle the homelessness and affordable housing crises in Seattle is more popular with Seattle voters than some local media outlets would lead you to believe.
Yeah, I'm always a little interested in seeing how the Seattle Times covers the city council. And one of the things that they're continually pointing out is that residents of Seattle are unhappy with and uncertain whether the city leadership can do anything about homelessness. And it's always framed in the Seattle Times as, Seattle residents want the city to lock up the homeless or drive them out of the city or do these sort of law and order type solutions, when in fact, I think it really stems from the fact that the city council first passed what looked like it could be a solution for the affordable housing crisis, the employee hours tax, and then turned right around and repealed it. And I think that disillusioned a lot of people and made them feel like they thought, like the city council and the mayor really weren't doing anything about.
And since then, in the 7 months since that repeal, the city's approach to homelessness has been strikingly incoherent and completely inadequate, culminating last month in the announcement that, well, we're going to take a couple of years and try and consolidate all these different departments that have a piece of the homelessness crisis. And that might take a couple of years, but, we'll keep working
or
on this.
We're going to focus on a countywide or a Puget Sound-wide solution. And that's been tried before, and there's not a really good plan going forward for how to make that work. How do you coordinate the Seattle City Council with the King County Council, with city councils in other areas like Linwood and Everett and Tacoma?
They have not even explained who exactly would have jurisdiction over that agency, how it's going to be funded, who's going to fund it.
Much less the solutions that they might come up with.
Yeah, and really they painted themselves into a corner with the repeal of the hours tax, because the scale of the solution that would be needed is going to incur the wrath of the business community almost no matter what, because honestly, that's where the money is. Individuals and property taxes and sales taxes have already been pretty much maxed out thanks to the vanity projects that Seattle is so fond of. But so they've really painted themselves into a corner in terms of long-term and institutional solutions.
It's a regressive tax structure. Yeah. I don't think you can put it down to vanity, solely down to vanity projects like the South Lake Union Trolley or the Mercer Corridor Beautification Project, or tearing down the viaduct to replace it with a really expensive traffic tunnel. Sure, those things cost a lot of money, but I don't think they're solely responsible for the inability for the city to find money for affordable housing. I think a lot of it has to do with priorities, yes, but another aspect of it is just our really regressive tax structure.
Yeah, and that goes back to the state legislature, which we've talked about a
lot over
the years.
And I'll talk about that more a little bit later. This morning or this afternoon.
I have to wonder too how much, as we still continue to wait for the internal emails from Durkin and her hired hands, which helped nuke the whole negotiation, which helped nuke the EHT vote. I have to wonder how much that is contained in those is a factor in the three people who have bowed out so far. We have to wait another couple months or whatever.
Well, I think in particular, Harrell as council president was vulnerable to that. And frankly, his tenure over the past couple of years as council president has been the most anti-democratic of any council president I can remember. He's been really resistant to public input. He's been very threatening of people who are vocal in city council meetings, especially around controversial votes. And to the point of, locking people out of public chambers at what's supposed to be a council meeting. I still remember when he agreed to have Ed Murray's swearing in, basically be a private affair where the public was locked out and the council chambers was reserved for Murray's family and friends, basically. That was unprecedented. And that kind of behavior has also alienated a lot of Harrell's constituents.
And there was a recent, I don't think it was exactly on the EHT, but there was a recent council session where like local judges and people who hadn't been there early were pushed to the front of the line for speaking where it was during what the recent housing issue.
I believe it was budget hearings.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I know that didn't go over well with people who had been waiting for hours to get in there to speak. And then, you know, you have this select group of people that are immediately pushed to the front of the line.
Privileged because they, you know, have money or they have position or they're in some respects considered better than the average person.
Corporate lobbyists who have to be somewhere, so they're pushed to the front.
Yeah.
That happened too.
That's been a feature of the city council under Harrell's presidency. And I think that that's one of the reasons why he's become widely unpopular.
All right. So enough on that. Moving on to court decisions regarding the SPD case.
Regarding the Seattle Police, couple of Seattle Police Department cases. The first one, King County Superior Court Judge Julie Spector this week dismissed negligence claims against the two Seattle police officers who shot Charlena Lyles in August 2017. Lyles's family members are suing the two officers in the city of Seattle. The judge's decision removes the two claims against the two officers, leaving the city only the claim against the city. Judge Spector gave no legal reasoning for why she dismissed the claims, but it appears she seems to have believed the lawyers for the two officers who argued that Lyles was in commission of a felony because the officer said that she was armed with at least one knife at the time that they shot her. Lyles was in her own home at the time that she was shot, with her young children playing in the next room. As an African-American woman, she'd had a history of bad interactions with the police, and she didn't trust them. In addition, she had both a history of physical abuse by former partners and a history of mental illness, which her family says that the two police officers should have had a record of and should have known of before they entered her home. And finally,
the real question there is how the actual dispatch was handled.
Yeah. And finally, one of the officers was trained and certified to use a taser, but he had left it in his locker before starting his shift that night in clear violation of SPD policy. The Lyles family have said that they are going to file an appeal to this decision by Judge Spector. I think it was unusual that the judge would have ruled this and not given any legal reasoning for why she did. But it is one of those cases in which you look at a case like this and you say, okay, the criminal justice system really discriminates against people of color, and it really discriminates against poor defendants. And in this case, it looks like the judge really was listening only to the lawyers who were supporting the two police officers.
Yeah, and also that there's a predisposition in the legal system for believing law enforcement officers, which newsflash, sometimes they lie.
Yeah. Now, the second Seattle Police Department case is also came before Judge Julie Spector in King County Superior Court. She agreed to review the arbitration agreement that seeks to reinstate Officer Adley Shepard. Shepard is the cop who punched a woman who was handcuffed in the back of his patrol car back in 2014. Now, the Office of Police Accountability investigated at the time, and they ruled that he had violated the Seattle Police Department's use of force policy. Former Police Chief Kathleen O'Toole fired him in 2016, but that didn't stick. Shepard appealed, and with the help of the Seattle Police Officers Guild, he was able to select a sympathetic arbitrator who ruled that Shepard should be reinstated with back pay. Now, the city is suing in court to reverse that arbitrator's decision. Judge Spector has agreed to hear the city's arguments to reverse the arbitration agreement instead of simply throwing out the case and declaring the arbitration agreement final, which is what the Seattle Police Officers Guild lawyers had argued before her. So we will see what happens, whether she will look at the arbitration agreement and go, okay, fine, or whether she will reverse it and say, yes, the decision made by the police chief at the time was the correct one. And I should also point out, too, that Shepard's case is a key part of the current negotiations between the city and the judge who was overseeing the Seattle Police Department reform process, Judge James Robart. He brought up Adley Shepard's case and said, okay, explain to me now how Seattle Police Department disciplinary procedures have changed if an officer can get fired for punching a woman in the back of who's handcuffed in the back of his police car and then choose his own arbitrator and get reinstated. Explain to me how that's changed. And he could, just over Shepard's case alone, reverse the police reform process and say, no, you got to go back to square one here. You're entering another 2-year period where you have to prove you've made these changes stick.
Yeah, and that would also avoid the SPOG contract that the city has agreed to.
Yeah, which is also part of that process.
All right. Moving on. State Supreme Court decisions affecting Seattle.
Yeah, affecting two city laws in Seattle. Back in 2016, voters passed Initiative 124. That was an initiative to improve the working conditions for hotel and motel workers. The law passed with a huge majority of 77% of the vote. The law required employers to provide hotel motel workers with health care coverage for or subsidies, limit each employee to cleaning 5,000 square feet of space per day, and provide them with an emergency panic button. The law also required employers to keep a list of guests who had assaulted or harassed employees in the past and then bar them from the premises in certain circumstances. Several hotel trade groups immediately sued to overturn the law. Go ahead, Jeff.
Because they'd much rather see their employees attacked by guests.
Yeah, attacked and assaulted by abusive guests. In 2017, a King County Superior Court judge dismissed the lawsuit, but the hotel groups appealed, and a state appeals court panel overturned the law late last year, ruling not on the substance of the initiative, but that the initiative included several items that didn't relate to one another, that it wasn't covering just one subject as required by state law. So the city of Seattle is now appealing that decision to the state Supreme Court. In the meantime, Mayor Durkin has said that she's willing to work on legislation with the city council in order to pass those provisions that are in the initiative into law, which would bypass the whole court process and make it law through a different route. Now, did you want to say something?
No, okay. No, go for it.
So now the second case. The state Supreme Court refused this week to hear the case against Seattle's income tax. In 2017, the city council passed a 2.25% tax on single people who make more than $250,000 per year and couples that make more than $500,000 per year. The city council called it an excise tax on high earners, not an income tax. But several Seattle residents sued, saying that it is indeed an income tax, which is prohibited by state law. Back in 1932, the state Supreme Court struck down a graduated income tax, saying that income is property and that the state constitution prohibits unequal taxes on property. In 2017, King County Superior Court Judge John Rule struck down the new Seattle tax. Instead of appealing to the Court of Appeals, the city then tried to skip over the Court of Appeals and asked the Supreme Court directly to take up the case and rule on the constitutionality of the law. This week, finally, more than a year after the city made that request, the state Supreme Court refused to take up the case and sent it back to the appeals court instead. Now, that's not unusual. In fact, I think most cases that are appealed directly to the state Supreme Court end up not being taken up by the state Supreme Court and sent back to the appeals courts. But it's just that the state Supreme Court sat on this case for so long. I'm not sure that that's a good sign that it will do well before the state Supreme Court when it's eventually appealed to them.
Yeah, and one of the purposes of the high earners tax by its backers when the city council passed it a couple years ago was to try and get a hearing before the state Supreme Court that would invalidate that 1932 ruling, mm-hmm. which is widely seen as legally vulnerable.
Particularly the part that ruled that income is property.
Yes, both because of the precedent of how much legal standards and economies have changed over the past nearly 100 years mm-hmm. since that ruling took place.
Yes. Washington is only one of 7 states with no state income tax. The other states are Texas, Florida, Alaska, Nevada, South Dakota, and Wyoming. We have one of the highest sales tax rates in the nation. Here in the city of Seattle, that sales tax rate is 10.1%. And of course, we have the most regressive tax structure in the country.
Yeah, and it's not even close.
It's not even close. Our tax structure forces poor people to pay such a high share of their income tax that there's no such a high share of their income in taxes versus what rich people pay that there is no other state in the nation that even comes close to us in that regard. Now, one of the things that I also want to mention, too, is that it's possible that the state Supreme Court is waiting for the Democratic-controlled state legislature to pass an income tax that they might take up in here first. It's possible that they don't want to set this precedent with just a local tax. They would prefer to do it with a state income tax, although I think that is crediting the Democrats in the state legislature with more courage than they actually have.
I think they could be waiting a very long time
for
that to take place.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we all could be pushing daisies by then.
Yeah. Basically the day that hell melts, which is shortly after it freezes over.
Yeah, and that was also one of the reasons why the city council went ahead and passed this, what they call the excise tax on high earners, is because they wanted to challenge the state Supreme Court's 1932 ruling, and they wanted a constitutional decision on an income tax because the state legislature has been kind of fiddling with this for decades now and has done nothing. And prior Democratic majorities in the state legislature have not done anything about it either. And it's pretty clear that they probably won't this time around in this legislative session either, because it was not, you know, a state income tax was not part of Governor Inslee's proposed budget. No, he still wants to talk about other measures to close tax loopholes, you know, for businesses, to raise the excise tax, the B&O tax on businesses, and things like that. But no mention at all of an income tax.
Yeah, and that's really nibbling around the edges of the very serious structural problem the state has with revenue. Those are patches. They don't have a long-term fix for our economy and for the state's revenue needs. And really an income tax is needed to address that, combined with a tax structure that really restructures the B&O tax, the property and sales taxes, all of it, so that you shift more of the tax burden onto the very wealthy.
Yeah, and now that infrastructure projects in the state of Washington, including transportation projects, have really suffered from a lack of revenue, you're starting to see business newspapers and business policy folks starting to talk now about how much the state of Washington needs an income tax, even though a lot of the businesses that are in Washington state are here precisely because they don't have to pay income tax.
Yeah, especially compared to California, which has a very high tax.
Yeah, I would say that's the reason why Amazon has not already moved to someplace like Chicago or New York. It's because they don't have to pay income taxes here in the state of Washington.
All right. Well, Inslee was coming out this week with joining the healthcare bandwagon with a possible solution.
This week, our governor, Jay Inslee, announced a bill that would set up a state public option healthcare plan to be offered on the state health insurance exchange, wahealthplanfinder.org. The public option plan would compete with private health insurance plans and provide a second option for the counties that only have one health insurance plan listed on the exchange. Those counties include Asotin, Chelan, Clallam, Douglas, Ferry, Garfield, Grays Harbor, Island, Okanagan. You're getting the drift here, right? It's most of the rural counties.
There are only seven counties, I believe, that are not included in that list.
Yeah, Pacific, Ponderace, San Juan, Skagit, and Wakayakum counties. It's a significant portion, perhaps the majority, of the state of Washington where residents have only one choice when they log into the state healthcare exchange. And so to address that fact and the fact that people are being forced to pay whatever the single option available wants to charge, that the governor has proposed this state-subsidized health insurance plan. Now, a lot of Democrats in the legislature think this is great, and they see this as a step towards eventually universal health care in the state of Washington. But there's a couple of downsides to it. One is that it's not the state actually rolling out health care like Medicare, for example. It's actually the state is going to be contracting with a private health insurer to provide comprehensive coverage, which means that the private health insurer is going to negotiate with the state for, you know, we need to charge X amount, we need to increase it by double digits, blah, blah, blah. And at some point, either the state will have to agree to those price increases and people will be paying more regardless of whether they're on the state plan or private insurance, or else the state is going to have to start forking over money to a private health insurer to subsidize lower premiums for the state health plan option. The governor has already mentioned that as part of this law, there will be subsidies so that people can afford the premiums, which means it looks like the state is going that route where they will be forking over that money to a private health insurance company in order to keep the premiums affordable. But there's no money in the legislation. There's no funding source for those subsidies as of yet. The governor's budget only includes about $500,000 in funding just to set up the state public option plan.
And the irony there is that the state for a number of years has operated the Washington State high-risk insurance pool, mm-hmm. which is a program for people who have chronic health conditions. And it's a supplemental plan to Medicare that the state operates for people who can't get supplemental plans on the open market or they're, you know, they're prohibitively expensive. So the state has some experience with that kind of subsidy, but they're not going that route under Inslee's plan.
No, they're going the private insurance route where, and you know, I mean, he's taken his cue from Obama, the whole idea of doing public health insurance exchanges. It was to provide a place where, okay, people can shop around, the plans will be comparable with each other, but they're still deeply tied to the private insurance market. So in no way is this a step towards government healthcare.
And the cynic in me wonders, you know, how much this is a serious proposal that he expects the state legislature to pass this year, and how much is it positioning for a potential presidential run where he can point at this and say, I proposed this, I proposed a carbon tax, I proposed these other things, none of which became law in Washington state,
yeah.
But they sound good on the stump.
Yeah, they sound good on paper, but, you know, and they sound good when he's up making a speech, but, you know, if they don't work in practice and if they don't address the need that's out there, for people who have to get insurance, but their only option is one private insurer on the WA Health Plan Finder Exchange, then you know it's not an initiative or a law that has accomplished anything. If anything, it's throwing money after a bad idea that will just keep us back at step one of the process of getting universal health care.
Yeah, I do think that there's an advantage to having to be able to choose between two private insurers rather than one, but it's not a real solution.
Yeah.
No, it's like being able to choose between two major parties for who you want in office.
The business party and
the business
the
party.
Business
and
party.
The extreme right-wing business party.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else on that?
No, let's move on to national.
Let's move on to national, starting with a new, but just finding out this week.
Why don't we just do kind of a little interim announcement that folks are listening to eat the airwaves on KODX?
They are. And they're actually listening back live again. Last week's was pre-recorded. This one is live because we are we're in the actual KODX studios as we speak. In this case, literally. Coming to you from the heart of the University District here in sunny Seattle, Washington.
And as you can tell, we're still figuring out this one-hour format.
Yes.
That's right.
And you can tell that it's live because you made a mention of sun, and that couldn't possibly be pre-recorded.
No,
not in January.
Had the joy of walking to the station this morning and walking by the farmers market. They were setting up as I was coming in. So
yes, go support the farmers. They are still growing and selling vegetables. it's cabbage season, and there's plenty of potatoes, and there are onions, and a lot of greens at the farmer's market. And, of course, there are a lot of other things from homemade cheeses to eggs to fresh baked bread.
Salmon.
Yeah. That was not a paid announcement, by the way.
No, that was not a paid announcement. That comes from a girl who grew up on a dairy farm. So on a family dairy farm, not a commercial dairy farm. So I really feel for those small farmers who sell their produce at the farmer's market, and they need the income during the winter time to help them buy seeds and get ready for the next planting season. So come on down to the farmer's market and show them a little love.
As do we here also at KODX. If you are excited about us doing Eat the Airwaves here live, surviving the purge over at KXP, and bringing over the other Mind Over Matters shows that we've aired so far today, then you can support us online via our website, kodxseattle.org. There is a Patreon button up in the top right corner if you want to make a monthly donation, or just send in a old-fashioned paper check to us.
Every size donation helps.
That's right. Yes. Every little bit helps.
Yep. So, $1, $1,000, whatever you want to do.
And we totally get it if you can't afford to, because so many of us can't afford just about anything these days. So moving on to national and new developments this week regarding the circus in D.C.
Yeah. Well, we had a bombshell story in the Seattle, right? like that's ever going to happen. The New York Times last night. Saying that the FBI had opened a counterintelligence investigation into Donald Trump as a possible agent of a hostile foreign power, namely Russia, in May of 2017. That's a year and a half ago, in the wake of the firing of James Comey as FBI director, the Russians in the Oval Office the next day, and the Lester Holt interview in which Donald Trump said a couple days later, I fired him because of Russia, this fake Russia thing. So it's a couple things that are important to remember about this revelation. It's helpful for context because it really is extraordinary that, you cannot get an investigation like that approved at what are literally the highest levels of the nation's law enforcement hierarchy were there not some fairly compelling evidence to support it. It's not just circumstantial evidence, and you can be sure that they have evidence that the public has not yet seen. Whether that evidence came from, phone calls, it came from foreign intelligence agencies, from allies. There's no telling where the sources may have come from, but certainly the concern at that level is not just because of what we've read in the papers, although there's certainly plenty of circumstantial evidence there to be concerned
although
about.
Although my feeling was, gosh, you mean the FBI was actually doing its job? Because exactly. It appeared to me at the time that Donald Trump was working on the behalf of Russia.
Well, we've been talking about that and speculating about that since the summer of 2016, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so the other question would be, well, yeah, of course, what took you so long? But so the context is helpful. For people who have been following the various investigations over the last couple of years, it shouldn't be much of a surprise, honestly, because there's been so much evidence and has continued to pile on with so much evidence that it's hard to imagine if Trump were, let's take a worst case scenario that Donald Trump is completely beholden to Vladimir Putin or to the Russian Federation and is doing everything possible to act on behalf of the Russian Federation and not the United States. What would he be doing differently? I'm not really sure you can point to anything that he would be doing differently.
Well, and then when you say it that way, I kind of see it a little bit differently. A person can be beholden to a foreign power if he gets a main source of income from them. And I think in Trump's situation, that the fact that Deutsche Bank loaned him so much money when so many other banks wouldn't, and that there appear to be these iffy deals where he helped Russians launder money, it seems to me like Donald Trump is in service of his own bottom line. And if that means kissing Vladimir Putin's behind, he'll do that.
And adding to that list, the desire to set up a Trump Hotel Moscow, which would have been the tallest skyscraper in Europe and would have been extremely profitable.
Oh yeah.
And the offer to give the penthouse in that development to Vladimir Putin.
So
himself.
I don't think there's any difference between him caring deeply about his own bottom line and that being a deep conflict of interest for someone who is serving as the president of the United States. That's where these investigations into violations of the emoluments clause and investigations into his own finances, which is where the Democrats in the House are going with their first investigations into Donald Trump and his affairs. They're going to want to look, and they are starting to request documents about his financial affairs.
Especially his tax returns.
That's where I think they're really going to find the smoking gun.
Yeah, and you know, the investigations into the Trump Organization's finances as well.
Yeah.
And you have the COO now being a cooperating witness. That hasn't gotten very much attention, but it's going to be very, very key.
But it's big, yeah.
So that revelation is forcing people in Washington to respond in predictable ways. Those people who are still working in Washington, that is. We'll get to that in a minute. You know, the standard for opening a full investigation is specific and articulable facts, which, again, likely includes information that isn't public yet. And it really has piled on over the last year and a half since that investigation was opened. In particular, I think a lot of people are going back and wondering once again what exactly was discussed during those 2 hours in Helsinki where nobody else was present except interpreters. And not just why did Trump demand that very unusual format, but what did he agree to? No, we have no idea. Nobody has any idea except Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin and those around Putin, presumably. It will all come in time. And we saw this week the first hearing held by the Democrats in the House, that being the hearing in which several committees called Steven Mnuchin, the Secretary of the Treasury to testify behind closed doors as to why he decided it was a priority to lift economic sanctions against Russian oligarch Oleg Deripaska, who was Paul Manafort's former boss and very closely linked to Vladimir Putin. And the solution by which the three companies that were exempted from sanctions, they're no longer supposedly controlled by Deripaska because he sold some percentage of each of those companies to other allies of Vladimir Putin. So it's a real question as to why the Treasury decided just before Christmas, when few people were paying attention, to make that decision. But coming out of that closed-door hearing, Democrats on the committee said that Mnuchin's testimony was very unsatisfactory and that he really never answered the question. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to be hearing more about that going forward.
And then there was the other revelation this week, too, that Paul Manafort had released polling data, some of it proprietary to the Trump organization, but to the Trump campaign, to his Russian friend Kilimnik, Konstantin Kilimnik, a guy who also has ties to Russian intelligence and to the Putin administration. And that Manafort, and we need to remember, too, that Manafort was working for Donald Trump for free. He wasn't getting a salary from Trump.
Yes, but he did owe Oleg Deripaska some $20 million.
Oh, yeah.
So was trying to pay that debt.
So it's clear who Manafort was working for. That's not something that you see framed very well in the mainstream media. They don't often point out that Manafort wasn't drawing a salary from Donald Trump when he was working for the Trump campaign. He was owing money to these Russian oligarchs. He was working on their behalf. And here we have a smoking gun to that, where he said, it's now been released to the public that, oh, yeah, he was providing all this polling data to his Russian counterpart.
Yeah, that's exactly the kind of polling data that you would want and able to say, you know, micro-target a social media campaign.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So there's a quid pro quo right there, as well as evidence of collusion. And, you know, you also have to remember, not only was Manafort working for free, but he did not start out working for the Trump campaign as campaign manager. He worked for several months before Trump decided to elevate him to campaign manager after he fired Corey Lewandowski because he has his little assault problems.
Yeah.
Lewandowski. So it was also on Trump, you know, as to why he elevated this guy who had already been working in his campaign along with a number of other people who had ties to Russia. He decided to have this guy be his campaign chair and his campaign manager.
His manager,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, he was turning around and reporting to his real boss in Russia. Mm-hmm. And I loved how we found out about this because it was a court document that was supposed to be redacted, but the Manafort's lawyers didn't do it correctly.
They messed up.
So where you cut and pasted the document into a Word document that you could read, suddenly the redaction disappeared. Oops. So, that was not supposed to be made public. And it's a reminder once again that the...
There's a lot of information that we haven't seen yet.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. Mm-hmm.
It's also a reminder that you want to have well-trained, skilled redaction technicians.
Or at least somebody who's passingly familiar with...
If you're going to cover your tracks.
Yeah, passingly familiar with, you know, software.
Yeah.
All right. Also this week, the shutdown continued.
Oh, yeah. I want to talk a little bit about some of the very bad effects of the shutdown. And yes, the parks are a filthy mess, and people are destroying a lot of sensitive habitat in our national parks. But aside from that, there are some other very, very bad effects of the shutdown. Some 40,000 federally backed mortgage applications are on hold because there's no one to review them. So there are 40,000 people or couples waiting to get their mortgages approved so that they can buy their homes. The SEC has stopped reviewing stock and bond offerings for public companies who now have to wait to raise the money that they need for their operations. The SEC has also stopped investigating securities violations and mergers and acquisitions. So Wall Street is going further unregulated under the Trump administration. The FDA has stopped inspecting food. The USDA is still inspecting domestic meat, but they're not being paid. So we're not sure about the quality of those inspections. The FDA inspects about 80% of what Americans eat. Foodborne bacteria sends 128,000 people to the hospital every year in spite of the inspections.
And that includes the regional FDA office in Seattle.
Yeah. Right? So without those inspections going on, I think folks just have to be very, very careful about what you put in your mouth. Wash it really good and cook the crap out of it. Otherwise, you could end up in the hospital, too. The Agriculture Department and the Commerce Department have stopped paying subsidies to companies who are affected by Donald Trump's trade tariffs. That includes all of the companies, well, many, many companies that use metals like aluminum and steel. Federally funded scientific research is being delayed or in many cases destroyed by the lack of funding or the interruption of important experiments and data collection. I think that's something that hasn't gotten much coverage at all in mainstream media, the fact that some studies that have been going on for years that rely on continuous data collection are going to be interrupted, and that could destroy this study altogether. And perhaps most importantly, the government has stopped providing data services, information services, that businesses, academics, healthcare professionals, scientists, politicians, even farmers rely on to make important decisions. Just one small example is the economic statistics that the Federal Reserve uses to base its decisions on whether or not to raise or lower interest rates. Another example is weather information and commodities pricing that farmers use to make their decision on what types of seeds to order, which they're doing right now for this spring's planting season. They don't know what crops to grow if they don't have good commodities market information. And last but definitely not least, is aid to impoverished Americans. The food stamp program only has reserves that will last until February, and then it will run out of money. The WIC program, which provides food for 7 million women, infants, and children, has already run out of money and shut down in many states, while in other states, the state governments are scrambling to find money to keep that vital program going. So I think when Donald Trump says it's the Democrats and, it's just a showdown over the wall, he's not telling you that women, infants, and children are being punished for his really bad, really poor political skills and his bad decisions in regards to immigration and this stupid border wall.
Yeah, and immigration courts and also federal courts in general are facing a lot of funding in the next few days.
Yeah.
That's going to run out as well. And there's no sign of resolution to this. This could go on for additional weeks or even months.
Yeah.
You know, there really is no clear path to resolving this, because the Democrats are firm that the border wall is ridiculous, which, you know, off the record, I think most Republicans agree with that as well. And Donald Trump, on the other hand, has never been told no all his life. And so he really doesn't know how to respond to it. He really doesn't know how to respond to the idea that he no longer controls one of the branches of Congress. And it's not like he could get what he wanted when the Republicans controlled both houses of Congress. So now that one house is controlled by Democrats, he needs to make an adjustment to his game plan, and he really doesn't know how to do that.
Yeah, and I just want to unpack this week, because it got so much press, Donald Trump's speech on the wall and all of his activities.
Oh, that was dreadful.
In which he lays out his argument for the wall. I just want to kind of unpack that and talk a little bit about some of his arguments. First off is to ask, he claimed that immigration is at crisis levels. Well, no, the number of immigrants crossing the southern border is far less now than it was just a couple of decades ago. But there is an immigration crisis that has been manufactured by Donald Trump and the Republicans in Congress, including overcrowded detention centers, the inhumane treatment of women and children, criminalizing of the legal process of asylum, metering at the border crossings to force immigrants to wait long periods of time in squalid conditions just on the other side of the border, and of course the government shutdown, which, as Job said, is straining the Border Patrol and immigration courts to their breaking point. He also argued that the wall would stop drugs from being smuggled across the border, and that is absolutely not true. The vast majority of drugs are smuggled across at legal checkpoints and border crossings. Building a wall will have zero impact on stopping the flow of drugs across the southern border, and a large volume of drugs gets smuggled across the northern border with Canada, especially marijuana and fentanyl from China. In fact, most of the fentanyl you can find on U.S. streets comes from China, not from Mexico or Central America. He also said that the wall will stop crime in places like Iowa and New Hampshire, which is patently absurd. The crime in Iowa and New Hampshire has nothing to do with immigrants from Mexico or Central America. If immigrants are the cause of crime waves, then why are cities in southern Texas some of the lowest crime cities in the nation?
Well, historically, immigrants, illegal and illegal, have a much lower crime rate than U.S. citizens.
Yeah, and Donald Trump's statistics on ICE arrests of criminal immigrants were just wrong. The total number was right, but the vast majority of those folks were arrested for traffic infractions, immigration violations, and drug possession, not violent crimes, as Donald Trump claimed. I don't know where he got that 100,000 figure. I could not find it anywhere among ICE reports. Only 8% of arrestees, according to the ICE, were convicted of assault, and less than 1% were convicted of sexual assault. In fact, the vast majority of people who commit sexual assault are white men over the age of 30, a demographic that Donald Trump fits into perfectly. And we know that he has boasted about committing sexual assault himself.
As well as being the target of a number of credible accusations of it.
Yeah. And Donald Trump said that terrorists are sneaking across the southern border. Well, that is also not true. Not a single terrorist attack on American soil has been committed by a person sneaking across the southern border with Mexico. And if the Justice Department had thwarted a terrorist attack by a person who had snuck into the country across the southern border, the Trump administration would have trotted that person out for the cameras a long time ago. But if you look at the Canadian border, yes, that is the case. According to the Cato Institute, which is a right-wing libertarian think tank, 7 individuals who snuck into the U.S. Have been prosecuted for planning terrorist attacks. They all came in via Canada or by jumping ship at U.S. ports. A report by the Department of Homeland Security and the Justice Department last year noted that U.S. agents intercepted 2,554 people on watch lists trying to enter the U.S. The vast majority of those folks were trying to board flights to the U.S., and they were not flying in from Mexico. And finally, the White House just recently, in December, sent a strategy document to Congress with steps to intercept terrorists before they enter the U.S. Nowhere in that document does it mention the need for a wall on the border with Mexico.
And underlying a lot of this is that, you know, the majority of people who are in the United States, in an undocumented fashion, entered the U.S. legally and overstayed their visas. That is not something that a wall would solve either.
Yeah. Now, he also said that Mexican immigrants are stealing your jobs, when in fact, no, they don't steal white Americans' jobs. They take the jobs that white Americans don't want to do, like cleaning your toilet and growing your food for you. In fact, U.S. farmers are in a bind right now because there aren't enough immigrants in the U.S. to provide steady help growing and picking crops and managing other agricultural production. Now, Donald Trump said that the wall would pay for itself. And of the many stupid things that Donald Trump has said, this one really takes the cake. It belongs in the same class as, quote, the tax cut will pay for itself, end quote, which, of course, never happens. Tax cuts never pay for themselves. They only increase the federal deficit. And likewise, a wall on the southern border with Mexico will never pay for itself. It will only increase the federal deficit. And the federal deficit, by the way, is nearing $1 trillion this year and may start to impact interest rates, which will impact the economy in a negative way. And finally, his assertion that the Democrats are against border security was also patently false. The Democrats and Republicans are pretty equally anti-immigrant. The Obama administration, don't forget, arrested more immigrants in 2009 than the Trump administration has in the last 2 years put together. And neither party has managed to pass immigration reform law that would protect people who were brought to the U.S. as children, the DACA folks, much less a law that would provide amnesty and a path towards citizenship for immigrants who have been in the U.S. for many years, people who have overstayed their visas, for example.
Although it is fair to point out that Congress had come to an agreement on that about a year ago, and Trump reversed himself and decided not to sign it.
Yeah.
So that's something that Congress has agreed to as part of the wall debate. But Trump backed down because it didn't.
But not in the majority that would have overridden his veto.
No, that's
and
true.
And now the Democrats are shouting about how they would love to pass a Republican bill that spends $1.3 billion to beef up border security and replace large sections of a fence that was a useless waste of money in the first place. Now, this whole Democrat versus Republican border security argument looks like a lot of nitpicking sometimes. $1 billion, $5 billion. It's all really a waste of money when our government should be doing two things right now. They should stop supporting the repressive dictatorships in Honduras and other Central American countries that are leading people to leave those countries to come here. And two, they should pass immigration reform that lets people enter the U.S. and gets them on a path to citizenship as productive taxpaying citizens. That's how you support your economy, not by creating a false labor shortage and depriving industries, whole industries, of the folks who typically make those industries run.
And I would add a third to-do item to that, which is, follow the existing U.S. law in terms of how to process asylum.
Yes,
seekers.
Exactly.
Because the Trump administration has been egregiously violating those laws for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
All right. On to, did you want to talk about Florida?
Sure, if we have time. Florida began
registering 7 minutes.
Okay, well, I can do that. Florida began registration this week of thousands of convicted felons, former felons who've, served their time and gone through probation and all the rest of it, under Amendment 4, which passed last November. This is going to fundamentally reshape the electoral composition of Florida. Preliminary statistics, and there are no clear numbers yet on the number of felons who've registered and how many have registered for which party, but it seems clear that given that a large percentage of the felons in Florida are non-white, registration is going to favor Democrats in Florida. But it's also, you're getting these stories out of Florida of people who've been waiting in some cases for decades to be able to vote after, relatively minor nonviolent crimes like marijuana possession. Florida was one of the few states, there are only two now remaining, that had a lifetime ban on convicted felons voting. Iowa is another state where that's still there. And I forget what the other one is, but the only two remaining that have that provision. Mm-hmm. And some I believe, 15 additional states that have some kind of restriction on felons' ability to vote after their sentencing. So so that was a very good news to see out of Florida. Given all of the headlines that have happened, including in Florida this past season around voter suppression, the idea of more people being able to vote is a welcome bit of good news.
All right. Is that our single good news item for the week?
That is, yes.
I made the mistake of promising that online.
You could
online.
Argue Bruce Harrell announcing that he won't run for...
Oh, yeah, okay. I'd include that, too.
All right.
Anyway.
Ryan Zinke.
Yeah, really major report this week that got very little media attention from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Report on the damage to the under the Interior Department as a steward of public lands and natural resources under Ryan Zinke as Interior Secretary over the last couple of years, and basically a front for the mining and the oil and gas industries. Under Zimke's watch, we saw a lot of federal lands being opened for sale, which meant that a lot of endangered species will no longer be protected, and which is having extremely damaging consequences for climate change. Just last week, Zinke appeared before the National Petroleum Council, now that he no longer has to work for the Trump administration. That's a government advisory panel that is
revolving
currently,
door.
Yeah, currently brim full of fossil fuel executives. At that appearance, he crowed about how President Trump has made the U.S., quote, the number one producer of oil and gas in the world. And Interior isn't the only science agency that has been turned into a billboard for political and ideological propaganda. The EPA has been similarly hollowed out. The Department of Health and Human Services has all but abandoned its duty to advance Americans' access to affordable health care. Interior took a multifaceted approach to trying to eliminate science from its policymaking. Zinke and his political appointees terminated research projects or canceled them before they started. Among the affected studies was one to evaluate the health effects of coal strip mining in Appalachia. Interior shut down a study in how to improve inspections of offshore gas and oil development, which had been requested by Interior itself after the 2010 Deepwater Oil Horizon oil spill. And it goes on and on. I would encourage people to go to the Union of Concerned Scientists website and check that out. It's
a great resource.
Yeah, it's a great resource. They do very good work, and this is a particularly vital work if you want to share it, talk about climate change and what's happening to our public lands under our own noses.
And a lot of scientists have become a lot more active in politics recently because of the Trump administration and their deeply anti-science bent and the way that they're trying to manipulate and use what science they allow to be done in service of some pretty horrible things.
Yep.
Oh, wow. All right. And finally, it appears the oceans are cooking faster than previously thought.
Yeah. A new analysis that was published Thursday in the journal Science found that the oceans are heating up 40% faster on average than the UN climate change panel estimated 5 years ago. That's extremely alarming news. The researchers also concluded that ocean temperatures have broken records for several straight years. This means that in addition to the acidification of oceans, we're seeing temperatures warm in a way that's fundamentally going to affect the biosphere. Not just
marine wildlife.
Exactly. Not just wildlife in the oceans, but also the biosphere on land. It's all connected, and the oceans are an important part of what drives that, both in terms of climate and in terms of habitat.
Yeah, and the warming ocean, I think a lot of scientists are agreeing now, is part of the reason why we're seeing these record sunny day flooding events. It's not the melting of glaciers that are contributing to that right now. Right now, it's because ocean temperatures are warming, and as water warms, it expands in volume. And that's what's driving a lot of the coastal flooding right now, and why we're seeing coastal flooding at rates that are much higher than scientists have predicted in the past, is because the ocean is warming at much higher rates and much faster than anybody thought it would.
Yeah, I noticed I was looking at the Miami Herald last night, looking at the Amendment 4 story, and they also had a story on how the septic systems in Miami-Dade County are failing, even though they were only instituted a few years ago, and that's exactly why.
Yeah.
They, you know, we've got a metropolitan area of 4 million people in the United States that is having to contend with the direct effects of climate change and is probably one of the most geographically vulnerable areas in the country for that. And nothing is being done at the federal level. Nothing.
Events.
Yeah. Actually, it started a little bit ago because we're not used to doing this in the afternoon. A 350.org peacekeeper training is happening right now at Rainier Beach Library, 9125 Rainier Avenue South, for the Women's March and the MLK March coming up next weekend. Also this afternoon from 1 to 4 o'clock, so it's already started, a workshop on how we create successful nonviolent campaigns and movements with George Lakey. That's at University Friends Meeting in the U District at 40th and 9th Northeast. And then next weekend at 9 a.m., when normally we'd just be getting off the air, but that's not true anymore. Now it'll be before we get here. The Seattle Women's March 3.0, that will be starting at Cal Anderson Park at Pine and 10th on Capitol Hill. They'll be marching downtown and then on to Seattle Center, the same route the last 2 years have gone. And be followed by movement building workshops at Seattle Center. Those will start at 11:30 next Saturday morning. So make your plans now. And of course, that's MLK Day weekend. And so the following Monday, the 21st, will be the annual workshops in March from Garfield High School.
All right.